Welcome to Encounter. Tonight the program deals with death, dying and euthanasia. It was first broadcast in October last year.
The aim of this conference is to generate light, to face our differences and to see what, if any, common ground may exist.
But first of all, some reflections on death itself. La Rochefoucauld in the 17th century remarked, one cannot look directly at the sun or at death. And we might put beside that Kipling's, I could not look on death, which being known, men brought me to it blindfold and alone.
We hope that there won't be any unnecessary display of strong feelings, but rather reasoned, careful argument.
Hello, I'm Margaret Coffey. Just a few weeks ago, I went to a conference on death, dying and euthanasia. It was held at St John's College at the University of Queensland, and it was the first of its kind, bringing together moral, legal, medical and religious perspectives on what one speaker described as the issue which will set the legal and moral tone for the 21st century. There were no dying people at the conference. The smell, the sight, the sound of dying were there only in the abstract and the imagination, and in stories. Professor Ian Maddox told this one.
I want to first of all just to tell you a little about a patient whom I'll call R, a man in his early 30s. Who died at our hospice recently. For 10 years, he'd been afflicted by osteogenic sarcoma, resulting in a hindquarter amputation, with tumour continuing to spread up into the remaining pelvis, so that he was comfortable only in a big chair, propped awkwardly to one side, half sitting, half lying, and steadily eroding pressure ulcers over his sacrum. Even with continuous infusions of high doses of morphine, he cried out whenever attempts were made to move him. Consistently, he challenged us. If I was a dog, you wouldn't let me suffer like this. Why can't you put me out of my misery? He indicated that he'd done all the business he could think of. He'd closed off all the affairs that needed to be addressed. On the wall by his bed was a framed letter from his 8-year-old daughter, explaining that she wanted to love him as she remembered him, and she couldn't bear to see him so ill and deformed, so she wouldn't be coming to visit. He felt it was time to finish. We struggled to make him more comfortable, devising a regimen by which he was anaesthetised briefly with intravenous ketamine every other day or every day for his dressings, and we'd lift him from his chair and put him on the bed and top him and tail him and change him and wash him and put him back in the chair, and then he'd wake up. And he accepted that regimen as an improvement, but he still challenged me. He didn't take up our suggestion of putting his big water chair into an access cab and taking him out to look at some of the sporting things that he'd previously enjoyed. He didn't want any outings at all. Perhaps there was a sense of shame of his deformed body. Perhaps it was a way of showing his anger at what had happened to him. I asked him whether he'd like to be more sleepy, even if he'd like to be asleep most of the time. But he preferred to be alert. Maybe so he could still challenge us, I wondered. Alert right up to his last days, venting his misery and helping all of us feel pretty inadequate. And finally, it was too great a struggle to remain awake, and he suggested and accepted a continuous infusion of Amitel, which kept him asleep and quiet until his death a day later, surrounded by his family. The reason he came to our hospice was to allow greater support than was able to be provided at home, to try for greater comfort and for quality in his remaining life. We were only partly successful. If the law had permitted me to do so, would I have taken up his challenge and administered a fatal injection? I think yes. Somewhere along the course of that month, as I recognised the consistency of his request, the lack of comfort in his day, the consent of his family for such a step, the failure of our efforts to facilitate a better quality in his life, I would not have moved quickly. I would have asked for an opportunity to struggle alongside him, in his discomfort and in his righteous anger, since quite often, from our efforts, discomfort does improve, misery and anger lift, and relationships prosper. But this didn't happen for R, and so we, along with his family, were relieved when the end finally came.
No rational man can die without uneasy apprehension, said Dr. Johnson, to which Boswell rather jauntily replied, in prospect death is dreadful, but in fact we find that people die easy. Why, sir, replied Johnson, most people have not thought much of the matter, so cannot say much, and it is supposed they die easy. Talk about death is largely talk about life.
Reverend Dr. Davis McKechnie, who gave the opening address at the Brisbane Conference. Today we present you with a sampling of the talk that went on over 3 days between doctors, lawyers, nurses, theologians and ethicists. Sit back and listen. We'll begin with death.
It is difficult to apply a rigid set of rules to each unique individual. We have, however, a fund of good advice from the past, when there were fewer choices in treatment and less was known about ways to prolong life. We aim to help the patient through the phase of denial to the stage of acceptance that death is coming and give him time to prepare for death and to become more tranquil and detached from the life around him. I consider that Australian society pays lip service to the right to die with dignity. The circumstances of most deaths still show our inhumanity to others. As a society, we have respect for life. We believe in the preservation of life, and our efforts are directed towards providing the highest quality of life possible. Society is death-denying. We want death to be unobtrusive. We don't want death to be an embarrassment to other people. And society generally doesn't want its social life disrupted. We try to control death and hide it. The elderly dying have retired from work and no longer have parental responsibilities. They are out of the mainstream of job holders and office bearers in society. Their deaths do not interrupt the smooth functioning of society. As a generalization, two-thirds of all deaths in industrialized societies are the result of biological decay and the infirmities of old age. Less than 10% of deaths in Queensland occur at home. 90% occur in hospitals, nursing homes, hospices, and frail aged hostels. Few young people, including the majority of young doctors, have seen a person die. Many people are frightened by the idea of caring for a dying person and do not know what to do when someone dies. The care which is given by medical and nursing staff in many acute hospitals satisfies an individual's bodily needs, but is impersonal. I do not think that this is as good a death as that at home, with its memories of happiness, laughter, and tears.
We in Australia have a diversity of cultures and of understandings of death with which to come to some kind of an understanding in our care of the dying. And I have not spoken of the most pressing need to take seriously Aboriginal understandings of death and mourning and the ceremonies which surround them.
The next speaker this afternoon, Professor James Hare.
I've been asked to look at the question, what is a good death, or more generally at the issue of death from a biblical perspective. Before I do this, there are three points which Christian theologians feel it necessary to make dealing with an issue such as this. The first is the issue of authority. God is the only and ultimate seat of authority, and all authority within the Christian community is founded on God.
I don't have a great understanding of theology, so a lot of it was lost on me.
Well, I was rather disappointed, Margaret, with his presentation, because I don't think he really brought the theological argument to bear on the ethical issues that we were discussing. And I think he made some rather big jumps in the theology of the Christian Church to the moral issue that we're talking about. The doctrine of God he spoke about, I think, is a doctrine that we start with, but we must go through many stages of reflection before we can apply our Christian principles to an ethical issue with other people who perhaps have a different starting point. And I think one of the weaknesses of the conference, as I would understand it so far, is that we haven't all put our cards on the table, our presuppositions about what we think a human person is and their origins and destiny.
First, any idea of orchestrating the beautiful death or the good death is something with which Christianity has very considerable difficulty. Death needs to be faced in a realistic way in which it is presented, whether one is in Christ or not.
Yeah, I'm very much aware of that, and I have some kind of a doubt in my mind. It's only that at the moment. The tenor of the times are very much towards control of our lives, control of our dying, and control of our death, and obviously in the area that I work in, orchestration of funerals, etc. And I'm just wondering if that really isn't against the basic religious impulse of being open to what is, in a sense, not having control, and allowing the community and, in the broader sense, God, to take charge, to let go, really. So that's why I have this doubt. At the moment, I haven't thought this fully through, about the idea, in which I'm involved quite often, of orchestrating funerals, planning them well in advance, from rainbow flags and balloons and specific music, etc., etc., and the readings, etc.
Secondly, it needs to be said that the factors of communal life need to be much more emphasized in current Christianity. Thirdly, I think that the element of the grace of a loving God needs to be apparent within this issue, and the grace of a loving and suffering God stands in a very important position.
Now, the incidence of cancer pain.
Dr. Jim O'Callaghan.
In 1985, it was estimated that there were approximately 9 million new cases each year, and that roughly 20 million people were suffering. By the year 2015, it's estimated that there will be 15 million new cases each year and 30 million sufferers. So we're talking about enormous numbers, especially with our general population aging. Of cancer patients, roughly 70% will complain of pain as a symptom, as a major symptom in their advanced state of disease. But unfortunately, figures show that worldwide only between 50 and 80% of patients are obtaining reasonable pain relief. So something's going wrong here. First of all, there's ignorance on the part of many medical practitioners. They're not aware of the best way to try and treat cancer pain. Secondly, there's the fear of addiction that I've already mentioned. And thirdly, there's a problem with trying to obtain morphine in many countries, both for economic reasons and for legal reasons. In 1980, roughly 2,300 kilograms of morphine was used to treat pain. This was monitored by the International Narcotic Control Board. In 1991, 11,000 kilos were consumed, but 60% was consumed by only 10 countries: Australia, New Zealand, the UK, USA, Canada, Sweden, Iceland, and a few others. The top 20 countries consumed 86%, and that left only 14% for another 100 countries. those other 100 countries contain most of the world's population. There were actually 60 countries that reported no use of morphine for medical purposes.
Fourthly and finally, the issues that are faced in this kind of discussion are those primarily related to a technologically advanced and wealthy society. The concentration upon certain kinds of euthanasia are not the central problems for the vast majority of humanity, nor for the vast majority of Christians. Thank you.
Most people die in hospitals or nursing homes, but the proportion who are dying in hospices and palliative care wards is slowly increasing.
I believe that it is a breach of the most fundamental of human rights and of human ethics and of human dignity to leave somebody in serious pain. We should actually sue healthcare professionals for malpractice for leaving people in pain.
Those who practice palliative care receive few requests for induced death. Dying is always sad, often difficult, and many of its elements are inaccessible to outside influences. Despite the fact that palliative care cannot relieve every patient's distress, I firmly believe that its general availability, which is an attainable goal in our society if we want it enough, would greatly reduce the call for euthanasia.
Pain and suffering are very closely related, and that there can be an organic basis for the relationship between the two. We're now starting to understand more about what's happening inside the spinal cord and why frustration, anger, stress, all these psychological factors can actually make real pain really worse. This is a definition of pain, which the International Association for the Study of Pain released in 1986. An unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, but more importantly, it's subjective, it's emotional, and it's unpleasant. On the other hand, suffering is not based on painful stimuli. This is a definition by Cassell in 1982. Suffering is experienced when an impending destruction of a person is perceived. It continues until the threat of disintegration has passed or until the integrity of the person can be restored in some other manner. It follows then that although suffering often occurs in the presence of acute pain, shortness of breath or other bodily symptoms, suffering extends beyond the physical.
A poem about the subjectivity of pain and suffering by Philip Larkin. Alistair Campbell was fond of quoting Larkin.
I would not dare console you if I could. What can be said except that suffering is exact, but when desire enters in, readings become erratic. I would like just to suggest that there are ways of finding some meaning in suffering. There is also a great danger in seeking to find any meaning in it. Much of our task, I believe, in trying to help people who are in pain, especially people who are in terminal illness and in severe pain, must be to dispose of the false meanings.
Alistair Campbell, Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the University of Otago.
People, for example, believe that they personally must have done something wrong and that so the suffering is a direct punishment for what they did. And that's not what most religions teach, and certainly not what Christianity teaches, where the suffering that we experience is part of our whole society's failures and not an individual's fault. Again, people are sometimes told, this will be good for you, it's good for your character, so don't worry, carry on. I think that's a very arrogant thing to say. Some people can make something out of suffering, but for others it's just impossible to do so. It very much depends on the quality of the relationships of those around you who are caring for you. That if somehow you can feel supported and understood and especially heard, people are hearing what it is that you need and are asking for, that then you can see that in all our lives there is suffering. Some is bearable, provided there are those to care for us through it.
Religions do not pretend we never die. They do not deny the reality of death. They seek to make sense of it in terms of some overarching account of the nature of human life, and in particular of the significance of the fact that we are finite beings. And the religious answer, if answer is the right word, is one which sees both loss and gain in the end of life.
You are listening to Encounter on Radio National, a report from the Conference on Death, Dying and Euthanasia held at St John's College in Brisbane. Each day, morning and afternoon tea was served in the courtyard.
It's been a fascinating day. A lot of interesting questions have been raised. Of course, there are different viewpoints, particularly in terms of whether or not we should have legislation to legalise euthanasia. I think that will be a long way down the track, but Queensland perhaps might move, with any luck, towards some of the legislation other states have brought in, things like the Enduring Power of Attorney Medical Treatment Act that Victoria now has in place.
Oh, I think it's wonderful. There's such a wide selection of people and their occupations here, and a few VE Society members. I think that so much will be gained from this, more so than having a conference of all voluntary euthanasia members, for instance, because there's no point in preaching to the converted.
The manner of our dying may break the nexus between our dying and our living. The fear of an inappropriate death, one which has no resemblance or continuity with what we have been or had hoped to be. Our relations and our recognition of our friends and family, our capacity to reason or to pray, haunts us all.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Professor Margaret Somerville.
What is euthanasia? Now, interestingly, there's often a similar broad definition by both the pro-choice groups on euthanasia and what I've called the anti-euthanasia groups. It's also interesting that they choose that very broad definition for exactly the same reason, but in another sense the opposite reason, because the pro-choice is saying, well, if some of these things are allowed, then all of them ought to be allowed because there's no fundamental or intrinsic difference between them. And the anti-euthanasia people say, well, we want to avoid people having lethal injections, and if it's true that these things are all the same, then we've got to prohibit everything, including pain relief that could shorten life, or refusals of treatment, or withdrawal of futile treatment, or whatever else it might be. I think they're both wrong. What we have to do in talking about euthanasia is be very careful that we know what we're talking about. Now, what I mean by euthanasia is an intervention or a non-intervention by one person to end the life of another person who's terminally ill for the purpose of relieving suffering with the intent of causing death, except where the primary intent is to relieve pain or other symptoms of serious physical distress. Or, and I, for instance, I would not include a valid refusal of treatment. I do not think that's euthanasia. I think that's refusal of treatment. So refusal of treatment by a competent person, including through advanced directives, is not euthanasia. And in my view, reasonably necessary treatment for the relief of pain or other symptoms of serious physical distress is not euthanasia. I also reject the active-passive distinction in euthanasia. I think passive euthanasia confuses withdrawing treatment when it's justified with withdrawing it for the purposes of euthanasia. Right, next question. Why are we talking about euthanasia now? I was at a recent conference in Boston, and one of the speakers got up and started, and I thought this was really sort of interesting. She said, well, She said one reason why she thinks the debate got so strongly off the ground in the United States is that the Americans are the only nation in the world who believe that death is optional. So they want to do something about it. But I think that there's a deeper truth to that statement. For a start, perhaps there is a very deep need, both for individuals and societies, to have death talk. And perhaps whether or not we believed in the religion or God or whatever it was, most of us got dragged off to church on Sundays until relatively recently. It was socially unacceptable for a lot of people not to go. So you were compulsorily subjected to this death talk. And I think what's happened is that with the decline of this, even if it was simply a facade of adherence to organized religion, we lost with that the forum for regular death talk. And the interesting thing was that, bad as it was for some people to go to church, well, they felt it was not a good thing for them to do, at least it was a very confined period. They could put it in there. It was a specified place, a specified person, and then they could forget about it for the rest of the week. Now what's happened is you can't pick up any newspaper, turn on any television or anything, except you've got this death talk all over the place, usually through the medium of talk about euthanasia. Connected to that is this notion of control. We are a controlling society, and in particular, the ultimate thing that we probably feel we can't control is death. So euthanasia doesn't give us the ultimate control of getting out of death, but it does allow us with some reality of control and at least a facade of control. We move from chance to choice.
Killing or letting die. It's from this perspective that I would like to view once more the euthanasia debate. It seems to me that at its essence, and this point has been made several times in the last few days, at its essence, the debate polarizes around the question of individual autonomy. The rest is propaganda for one side or the other.
It has been a little bit one-sided.
Dr. Malcolm Parker, President of the Voluntary Euthanasia Society of Queensland.
Question. It's a death, dying and euthanasia conference, and a lot of the attention has been paid to how we can assist people in the palliative care sense, and people on either side of the euthanasia debate don't have any real disagreements in that sort of area. So as far as a conference which is devoted to looking at the harder questions, there's been, it seems to me, not as much emphasis on that as there should have been, and a little bit of partisan arrangement. I've been the only speaker speaking specifically on the pro-euthanasia side.
You used interesting language in your paper. You, in a way, appropriated the expression sanctity of life from theologians. Other people have made a point of not wanting to use that sort of expression because of its religious overtones.
Well, I think that sanctity of life is still a working concept, even with many people who don't regard themselves as Christians or theists in any way. Because I think that it still encourages us to think that prima facie, our obligation should be to preserve life, to respect people's lives, to respect their autonomy and their liberty and so on. I don't see that it's particularly serious that we, or a problem that we use certain terms, as long as we understand what we mean by them when we're using them.
Well, my response to that would be that it's necessary sometime for the proponents of euthanasia to take this language and incorporate it into their program, because it is very powerful and significant language, but they use it in a way that perhaps I wouldn't agree with as a Catholic priest or say more generally a Christian. I wonder whether they would talk about the holiness of life, because after all that's what sanctus or sanctity means, holiness. Now obviously I don't think they're talking about quite the same thing. When we're talking about holiness, we're talking about something in relation to God. And I'm not sure that when they talk about the sanctity of life, they are using it in that way. Perhaps they're indicating its general respect in the human community, the respectability of life or whatever. I'm not sure. I don't think we've put all those terms out on the table and examined them well enough, able to have a true meeting of minds and genuine disagreements and therefore perhaps resolutions of difficult problems, and until we do that sort of thing.
I mean, if you have a pet animal or something like that and you do not put it out of its misery...
You mean kill it?
Well, put it to sleep. I mean, I don't like the word killing or death.
Well, but that's what we're dealing with, aren't we, at this conference?
Well,
we're dealing
right.
with death.
That's right. But, I mean, if you leave an animal suffer, somebody will report you to the RSPCA because you're being cruel to animals. But if you were to do the same thing with a human being, you would be reported to the police. And I just can't see the point of, if you can do that with an animal, why can't you do it with one of your loved ones? You can see them just go out peacefully, quietly, without all the indignity and pain.
Talking about suicide is a way of putting some moral realism into the debate.
Professor David Brown came from England. He is Professor of Divinity at the University of Durham.
In the 13th century, St. Thomas Aquinas used three arguments which have been repeatedly used since. The appeal to natural law, the appeal to social obligations, and the appeal to providence. And so it's interesting to consider what plausibility they might have in our own day. To my mind, none is quite satisfactory as it stands. But each can, I believe, nonetheless, be used to say something of great importance to our own day. So I'm going to try and defend all three.
Part of being a Christian is being part of a tradition. So it's not being just the Bible that speaks to us about who and what it is to be a Christian, but also the 2,000 years that have come since. And although they're often addressing very different contexts from our own, as is the case with Aquinas, it's fascinating to try and see if there's continuity.
Were active euthanasia to be institutionalised, it's conceivable that this could be done without public committees supervising the process. And the result would be yet further erosion of the personal character of care. But more important still is what such judgments and the actions following on them would imply. For it's one thing to abide by a patient's wishes regarding cessation of treatment. Quite another directly to take his life, whether by consent or otherwise. In the former case, one respects his dignity as an individual charged with making his own decisions, right or wrong. But in the latter case, one endorses those decisions. One accepts the judgment on the value of the life that the action implies. The doctor cannot claim indifference to the aim because the action he does has also made it his own. But once a doctor has made such a judgment his own, consistency demands that he views all like cases similarly. So even where consent is not forthcoming, will he not judge that life also as valueless? Of course, the absence of consent may restrain him, but can those who are alone or vulnerable be quite so sure? I began this essay by suggesting that the penalty for murder is out of all proportion to its adverse consequences for society as a whole, precisely because it thereby assures us that we all possess intrinsically the same fundamental worth. I end by observing that a shallow understanding of autonomy and compassion could yet destroy that value. Thank you.
we all must die. Unique in the exact sense of that much abused word, in that each man, woman, child goes his or her own way and is related to the world through his or her own series of relationships. For the men or women of faith, each is uniquely related to God. Into this intensely personal, infinitely differentiated world comes medical science, which properly and necessarily must proceed by generalization, by comparing like with like. We now have a way of speaking about death which, if it is to help anybody, must think in terms of cases and indeed in some respects in statistics. Patterns emerge.
How then are we to balance the value of a life, even the sanctity of a life, against the requirement that available resources be rationed and against the further requirement that what resources there are should be fairly and justly distributed? The position I am advancing is a further refinement of the ordinary, extraordinary means criterion of withdrawing or withholding treatment. This criterion has sometimes been represented rather crudely in terms of differing degrees of sophistication in technology. Sophisticated technology may be withdrawn, common resources should continue to be applied. I do not believe the criterion was ever meant to be so crudely applied, although, of course, the cost of the treatment, and thus often, indirectly at least, its sophistication, is a factor that should be taken into account. But other factors, including the proximity or remoteness of the terminal condition, the likely effectiveness of the treatment, and its burdensomeness to the patient, are, generally speaking, more important and more relevant criteria. But the claims of other patients to this resource or to parallel resources are also factors to be taken into account in assessing whether this allocation is or is not an extraordinary or, better, a disproportionate means.
Economic factors, be they at the family level or the higher levels, are relevant because it is a fact that some people will want to and do take those factors into account when they're thinking about these very important decisions. And if we rule out from any sort of consideration those sort of factors, then we are in fact proceeding in some way against the autonomy of the people who want to include those factors in their deliberations. If we make it clear that economic considerations are not overriding, but that economic concerns may well figure in people's deliberations, then the choice remains truly free, since people will have no reason to resent having such a choice to make. Given this situation, a certain economic benefit would flow, whose size would depend on just how many decisions were made and in what circumstances. It is also likely that if living will legislation were made available in conjunction with such decisions, economic benefits perhaps could be somewhat greater.
Thanks very much, Dr. Malcolm. And then if we have a couple of minutes to buzz to speak to one another.
In the Australian Capital Territory, the conference was told, a bill is before the Parliament.
An instrument of the Legislative Assembly of the Australian Capital Territory. It is a private member's bill by Mr. Moore. It is called the Voluntary and Natural Death Act of 1993. And it says here it is a bill for an act to make provision with respect to the withholding or withdrawing of medical treatment from and the administration or provision of drugs to induce the death of persons who are terminally ill. The first form is a schedule which is said to be a written direction under the Voluntary and Natural Death Act 1993 that I, of Queen Bean or wherever, direct that I, if I become terminally ill, extraordinary measures shall be withheld or withdrawn from me. Right, Natural Death Act, straightforward, many statute books. Two, drugs to induce my death shall be administered to me. And you're allowed to choose between the two. Careful that you tick the right one. There is no doubt this, if passed by the ACT legislature, would be a world first and would be in advance, in inverted commas, of the present position in the Netherlands, their recent legislation notwithstanding. It would not go as far as this proposed act.
The committee is still open to receive submissions from interested members of the public. Submissions on the bill close on the 31st of December. So that anybody who wishes to place a submission before the committee can write to the committee secretary, ACT Legislative Assembly, Canberra.
...130 submissions have been sent in already. If you would like information about the conference, death, dying and euthanasia, contact St John's College at the University of Queensland in Brisbane. They hope to publish a book. Technical production was by Neil Hobbs and I'm Margaret Coffey.
You talk about the Dutch position, and of course there is a legal position, and there it's certainly true that there's fairly extensive practice of euthanasia in Holland. What you find when you talk to the people is that there's an enormous variety of interpretation of what's allowed and what is not allowed. And it ranges from, for instance, I was at a cocktail party and I was speaking to this woman doctor, and I said, you know, I really don't understand how you feel that it's okay, especially on such a large scale, to carry out euthanasia through lethal injections. By the way, some of you may not know how the Dutch most frequently do euthanasia. It's to give an injection of curare followed by a large dose, an overdose of sodium pentothal is the usual manner of doing it. The woman whom I was speaking to said to me, look, I'll give you a case of euthanasia where I'm sure that you will agree. And what I thought she was going to tell me about was something like Lou Gehrig's disease, where I think a lot of us feel, God, if I was in that situation, I probably would want a lethal injection as well. Instead of that, she said, look, there's this old woman. She was 83. She was married to a Dutch diplomat. They were both highly intellectual. They had this incredible life. They had this library of books. They lived in different parts of the world. He died. She got lonelier and lonelier and lonelier. We used to visit her every week, and every week she'd say to us, please give me a lethal injection. So she said, after about 3 months, we did. And she said, you know, it was a terrible situation. She had nothing to live for. She said she had no family, her friends had all died, her husband, who'd been the centre of her life in every way, was gone. And I said to her, because I kind of like cats, you see, I said, did you think about buying her a cat? And she looked at me and she said, completely seriously, she said, what a good idea.
But the cat came back the very next day. They thought he was a goner, but the kitty came back, 'cause he would.